The Protea Castle had been a mail ship of the Union Castle Line. She was a fast, three-funnelled passenger liner which had operated on the Cape Town to Southampton run before being converted to a hospital ship and repainted pristine white with scarlet crosses on her sides and funnels. She lay at the dock of the inner harbour of Calais, taking on her passengers for the southward voyage, and they were a far cry from the elegant, affluent travellers who had filled her pre-war lists. Five railway coaches had been shunted onto the rail spur of the wharf, and from these the pathetic stream of humanity crossed to the liner and went up her fore and aft gangways. These were the veritable sweepings of the battlefield. They had been rejected by the medical board as so incapacitated that they could not even be patched up sufficiently to feed the man-hungry Baal of the British Expeditionary Force. There would be 1,200 on board for the southbound voyage, and on the return northbound leg the Protea Castle would be repainted in the camouflage of an ordinary troop ship and bring another load of young, eager and healthy young men for a sojourn in the hell of the trenches of northern France. Santin stood beside the rolls at the wharfside and stared with dismay at this ruined legion as they went aboard. There were the amputees, missing an arm or a leg, the lucky ones with a severance below knee or elbow. They swung across the wharf on their crutches or with an empty sleeve of their tunic pinned up neatly. Then there were the blind, led by their companions, and the spinal cases carted aboard on their stretchers, and the gas victims with the mucous membranes of their noses and throats burned away by the chlorine gas, and the shell-shocked who twitched and jerked and rolled their eyes uncontrollably, and the burn victims with monstrous pink shiny scar tissue that had contracted to trap their limbs into the bent position, or drawn down their ravaged heads onto their chests, so that they were as twisted and contorted as hunchbacks. "You can give us a hand, dear love?" One of the orderlies had spotted her uniform, and Santin roused herself. She turned quickly to the Zulu driver.
"I will find your father in Mbajane."
"Mbajane?" Sangane grinned happily that she had the name right.
"And I will give him your message. Go in peace, little lady."
Santin clasped his hand, then snatched her carpet bag from him, and followed by Anna, hurried to her new duties. The loading went on through the night, and only when it was completed a little before dawn were they free to try and find the quarters that they had been allocated. The senior medical officer was a grim-faced major, and it was apparent that word had been whispered to him from on high.
"Where have you been?" he demanded when Santin reported to his cabin. "I have been expecting you since noon yesterday. We sail in 2 hours."
"I've been here since noon, down on sea deck, helping Dr. Solomon."
"You should have reported to me," he told her coldly. "You can't just wander around the ship suiting yourself. I am responsible to General—" He cut himself off and went off on a new tack. "Besides, sea deck is other ranks."
"Pardon?"
Through practice, Santin's English had improved immeasurably, but many terms still eluded her.
"Other ranks, not officers. From now on, you will be working with officers only. The lower decks are out of bounds to you. Out of bounds," he repeated slowly, as though speaking to a backward child. "Am I making myself clear to you?"
Santin was tired and not used to this type of treatment.
"Those men down there hurt just as much as the officers do," she told him furiously. "They breathe and die just like officers do."
The major blinked and sat back in his chair. He had a daughter the same age as this French chippy, but she would never have dared answer him like that.
"I can see, young lady, that you are going to be a handful," he said ominously. "I did not like the idea of having you ladies on board. I knew it would lead to trouble. Now you listen to me. You are going to be quartered in the cabin right across from mine," he pointed through the open door. "You will report to Dr. Stewart and work to his orders. You will eat in the officer's mess, and the lower decks are out of bounds to you.
I expect you to conduct yourself with the utmost propriety at all times, and you can be certain that I will be keeping a very sharp eye on you." After such a bleak introduction, the quarters that she and Anna had been allocated came as a delightful surprise, and again she suspected that the hand of General Sean Courtney had moved. They had a suite that would have cost 200 guineas before the war, twin beds rather than bunks, a small drawing-room with sofa and armchairs and writing-desk, and their own shower and toilet, all tastefully furnished in autumn shades. Santerne bounced on the bed and then fell back on the pillows and sighed blissfully.
"Anna, I'm too tired to undress."
"It's your nightdress," Anna ordered, "and don't forget to clean your teeth."
They were awakened by the alarm gongs ringing, the blast of whistles in the companionway, and a hammering on the cabin door. The ship was under way, vibrating to her engines and working to the send of the sea. After the first moments of panic, they learned from their cabin steward that it was a boat drill. Dressing and strapping themselves hastily into their bulky life jackets, they trooped onto the upper deck and found their lifeboat station. The ship had just cleared the harbour breakwater and was standing out into the channel. It was a grey, misty morning, and the wind whipped about their ears so that there was a general murmur of relief when the stand down was sounded and breakfast was served in the first-class dining room, which had been converted into the officers' mess for the walking wounded. Santerne's entrance caused a genteel pandemonium. Very few of the officers had realised that there was a pretty girl on board, and they found it difficult to conceal their delight. There was a great deal of jockeying for position, but very quickly the first officer, taking advantage of the fact that the captain was still on the bridge, exercised his rank, and Santerne found herself installed at his right hand, surrounded by a dozen attentive and solicitous gentlemen, with Anna seated opposite, glowering like a guardian bulldog. The ship's officers were all British, but the patients were colonials, for the Protea Castle was going on eastwards after rounding the Cape of Good Hope. Seated around Santerne, there was a captain of Australian Light Horse who had lost a hand, a pair of New Zealanders, one with a piratical black patch over his missing eye, and the other with an equally piratical Long John Silver wooden stump, a young Rhodesian named Jonathan Ballantyne, who had won an MC at the Somme, but paid for it with a burst of machine-gun fire through the belly, and other eager young men who had lost all parts of their anatomy. They plied her with food from the buffet.
"No, no, I cannot eat your great English breakfast. You will make me fat and ugly like a pig."
And she glowed at their concerted denials. The war had been in progress since Santerne was a mere 14 years old, and with all the young men gone, she had never known the pleasure of being surrounded by a horde of admirers. She saw the senior medical officer scowling at her from the captain's table, and as much to spite him as for her own amusement, she set herself out to be pleasant to the young men surrounding her, although she felt a stirring of guilt that she might be less than faithful to Michael's memory. She consoled herself.
"It is my duty. They are my patients. A nurse must be good to her patients."
And she smiled and laughed with them. And they were pathetically eager to catch her attention, render small services for her, and answer her questions.
"Why are we not going in convoy?" she asked. "Is it not dangerous to go down Channel en plein soleil in broad daylight? I have heard about the Rewa."
The Rewa was the British hospital ship with 300 wounded on board that had been torpedoed by a German U-boat in the Bristol Channel on January 4th that year. Fortunately, the ship had been abandoned with the loss of only 3 lives, but it had fueled the anti-German propaganda, displayed in most public places with the posters headed, "What a red rag is to a bull, the Red Cross is to the Hun," with a graphic account of the atrocity beneath. Santerne's questions precipitated a lively argument at the breakfast table.
"The Rewa was torpedoed at night," Jonathan Ballantyne pointed out reasonably. "The U-boat commander probably didn't see the Red Crosses."
"Oh, come now, those U-boat chaps are absolute butchers."
"I don't agree,"
They're just ordinary fellows like you and me. The captain of the ship obviously believes that too. That's why we are covering the most dangerous down-channel leg in daylight to let the U-boats get a good look at our Red Cross markings. I think they'll leave us alone, once they know what we are. Nonsense, damned Huns would torpedo their own mothers-in-law. So would I, mind you. This ship is steaming at 22 knots, the first officer reassured Santan. The U-boat is capable of only 7 knots when submerged. It would have to be lying directly in our track to have any chance of a shot at us. Odds of 1,000,000 to 1, miss. You don't have to worry at all. Just enjoy the voyage. A tall, round-shouldered young doctor with a mild scholarly air and steel-rimmed spectacles stood before Santan as she rose from the breakfast table. I am Dr. Archibald Stewart, Nurse Lethierry, and Major Wright has put you in my charge. Santan liked the new forms of address. Nurse Lethierry had a nice professional ring to it. She was not so certain that she enjoyed being in anyone's charge, however. "Do you have any medical or nursing training?" Dr. Stewart went on, and Santan's initial liking for him cooled. He had exposed her in the first few seconds, and in front of her new-found admirers. She shook her head, trying not to make the confession public. But he went on, remorselessly. "I thought not." He eyed her dubiously, and then seemed to become aware of her embarrassment. "Never mind. A nurse's most important duty is to cheer up her patients. From what little I've seen, you are very good at that. I think we'll make you chief cheer-upper, but only on A-deck. Strict orders from Major Wright. A-deck only." Dr. Archibald Stewart's appointment turned out to be inspired. From an early age, Santan's organizational skills had been honed in the running of the Chateau of Mortomme, where she had been her father's hostess and assistant housekeeper. Effortlessly, she manipulated the band of young men that had gathered about her into an entertainments team. The Protea Castle had a library of many thousands of volumes, and she quickly instituted a distribution and collection scheme for the bedridden cases, and a roster of readers for the blind and illiterate amongst the men on the lower decks. She arranged smoking concerts and deck games and card tournaments. The Comte had been a wicked bridge player and taught her his skills. Her team of one-eyed, one-legged, maimed assistant alleviators of the boredom of the long voyage vied with each other to win her approval and render their services, and the patients in the tiers of bunks thought up a dozen tricks to delay her beside them when she made her unofficial rounds each morning. Amongst the patients was a captain of the National Mounted Rifles who had been in the convoy of ambulances during the retreat from Mortomme, and he greeted her ecstatically the first time she entered his ward with her armful of books. "Sunshine! It's Sunshine herself!" And the nickname followed her about the ship. "Nurse Sunshine," when the usually surly Chief Medical Officer Major Wright used the nickname for the first time, Santen's adoption by the ship's company was unanimous. In the circumstances, there was little time for mourning, but every night just before composing herself for sleep, Santan lay in the darkness and conjured up Michael's image in her mind's eye, and then clasped both hands over her lower stomach. "Our son, Michel. Our son." The brooding skies and brutal black seas of the Bay of Biscay were left behind on the long white wake, and head of the bows the flying fish spun like silver coins across the blue velvet surface of the ocean. At latitude 30 degrees north, the debonair young Captain Jonathan Ballantyne, who was the reputed heir to the 100,000-acre cattle ranches of his father Sir Ralph Ballantyne, Prime Minister of Rhodesia, proposed marriage to Santan. "I can hear poor papa," Santan mimicked the Comte so accurately that it cast a shadow in Anna's eyes.
100,000 acres, you crazy wicked child. Tiens alors, how can you refuse 100,000 acres?
And after that, the marriage proposals became an epidemic. Even Dr. Archibald Stewart, her immediate superior, blinking through his steel-rimmed spectacles and sweating nervously, stammered through a carefully rehearsed speech and looked more gratified than abashed when Santan kissed both his cheeks in polite refusal. At the equator, Santan prevailed on Major Wright to don the regalia of King Neptune, and the crossing ceremony was conducted amidst wild hilarity and widespread inebriation. Santan herself turned out to be the main attraction, clad in a mermaid costume of her own design. Anna had protested strenuously at the décolleté, all the while she helped to sew it, but the ship's company adored it. They whistled and clapped and stamped, and there was another rash of proposals immediately after the crossing. Anna huffed and gruffed, but secretly was well content with the change she saw coming over her charge. Before her eyes, Santan was making that wonderful transformation from girl to young womanhood. Physically, she was beginning to bloom with early pregnancy. Her fine skin took on a luster like mother of pearl. She lost the last vestiges of adolescent gawkiness as her body filled without losing any of its grace. However, more powerful were the other changes, the growing confidence and poise, the awareness of her own powers and gifts that she was only now beginning to exercise fully. Anna had known that Santan was a natural mimic, could switch from the Midi accent of Jacques the groom to the Walloon of the chambermaids and then to the Parisian intellectual of her music teacher. But now she realized that the child had a talent for languages which had never been tested. Santan was already speaking such fluent English that she could differentiate between the Australian and South African and pure Oxford English accents and take them off with startling accuracy. When she greeted her Aussies with a dinky g'day, they hooted with delight. Anna had known also that Santan had a way with figures and money. She had taken over the family accounts when the estate factor had fled to Paris in the first months of the war, and Anna had marvelled at her ability to cast a long column of figures simply by running her pen down it, without the laborious carrying over of digits, and without moving her lips, all of which Anna considered miraculous. Now, Santan demonstrated the same acumen. She partnered Major Wright at the bridge table, and they made a formidable pair, and her share of the winnings flabbergasted Anna, who did not really approve of gambling. Santan reinvested these. She organized a syndicate with Jonathan Ballantyne and Dr. Stevens, and they were big punters on the daily auction and sweepstake on the ship's run. By the time they crossed the equator, Santan had added nearly 200 sovereigns to the hoard of Louis d'Or they had salvaged from the chateau. Anna had always known that Santan read too much. "It will damage your eyes," she had warned her often enough, but she had never realized the depth of the knowledge that Santan had gathered from her books, not until she heard it demonstrated in conversation and discussion. She held her own even against such formidable debaters as Dr. Archibald Stewart, and yet Anna noticed that she was cunning enough not to antagonize her audience by ostentatiously flaunting her learning, and would usually end an argument on a conciliatory note that allowed her male victim to retreat with only slightly ruffled dignity. "Yes," Anna nodded comfortably to herself as she watched the girl blooming and opening like some lovely flower in the tropical sunshine. "She's a clever one, just like her mama." It seemed that Santan really had a physical need for warmth and sunlight. She would turn her face up to the sun every time she went on deck.
"Oh, Anna, I did so hate the cold and the rain. Doesn't this feel wonderful?"
"You are turning ugly brown," Anna warned her. "It's so unladylike."
And Santan considered her own limbs thoughtfully.
"Not brown, Anna. Gold."
Santan had read so much and queried so many people that she seemed already to know the southern hemisphere into which their ship now thrust its bows. Santan would awake Anna and take her onto the upper deck to act as chaperone while the officer of the watch showed her the southern stars. And, despite the late hour, Anna was dazzled by the splendours of this sky that each evening revealed more of itself before their upturned eyes.
"Look, Anna, there is Archena at last. It was Michael's own special star. We should all have a special star," he said, "and he chose mine for me." "Which is it?"
Anna asked. "Which is your star?"
"Ekrax, there. The brightest star in the Great Cross. There is nothing between it and Michael's star except the pivot of the whole world, the celestial South Pole. He said between us we would hold the axis of the earth. Wasn't that romantic, Anna?"
"Romantic twaddle," Anna sniffed, and secretly regretted that she had never had a man to say such things to her. Then Anna came to recognize in her charge a talent that seemed to make all the others paled. It was the ability of making men listen to her. It was quite extraordinary to see men like Major Wright and the Protea Castle's captain actually keep silent and attend without that infuriatingly indulgent masculine smirk when Santen spoke seriously.
"She's only a child," Anna marvelled. "Yet they treat her like a woman. No, no, more than that even. They are beginning to treat her like an equal."
That was truly astonishing. Here were these men according to a young girl the respect that thousands of other women, Emmeline Pankhurst and Annie Kenny at their head, had been burning property, throwing themselves under racehorses, hunger-striking and enduring prison sentences to obtain, so far unsuccessfully. Santen made the men listen to her, and very often she made them do what she wanted. Although she was not above using the sly sexual tricks to which women over the ages have been forced to resort, Santen achieved her ends by adding logic, cogent argument, and force of character. These, combined with an appealing smile and level look from dark, fathomless eyes, seemed irresistible. For instance, it took her a mere 5 days to get Major Wright to rescind his order confining her to Adak. Although Santen's days were filled to the last minute, she never for a moment lost sight of the ultimate destination. Each day her longing for first sight of the land where Michael had been born and where his son would be born became stronger. However busy she was, she never missed the noon shot, and a few minutes before the hour she would race up the companionway to the bridge and arrive in a swirl of her uniform skirts, gabbling breathlessly, "Permission to enter the bridge, sir." And the officer of the watch who had been waiting for her would salute, "Permission granted. You are only just in time, sunshine." Then she would watch, fascinated, as the navigating officers stood on the wing of the bridge with their sextants raised and made the noonday shot of the sun, and then worked out the day's run and the ship's position and marked it on the chart. "There you are, sunshine, 17 degrees 23 minutes south, 160 nautical miles northwest of the mouth of the Kunene River, Cape Town in 4 days' time, God and the weather permitting." Santen studied the map eagerly.
"So we are already off the South African coast?"
"No, no, that is German West Africa. It was one of the Kaiser's colonies until the South Africans captured it 2 years ago."
"What is it like? Jungles? Savannas?"
"No such luck, sunshine. It's one of the most godforsaken deserts in the entire world." And Santen left the chart room and went out onto the wing of the bridge again, and stared into the east towards the great continent that still lay far below her watery horizon.
"Oh, I can barely wait to see it at last,"